This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Charles, Camilla, and Diana, the royal love triangle exposed.
Just who will inherit Anna Nicole Smith's estate?
And all the Joneses and the Smiths out there, all of us together.
Are you trying harder and harder to get things done? Stop it. Stop it right now and enjoy your life. You might live longer and help save the planet as well. That's the message from Cecile Andrews, author of Slow is Beautiful. Her book tour speech of the same name has been heavily downloaded from our website. Now Cecile has a new book out this year called Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and a Lasting Happiness, co-authored with Wanda Urbanska. Way back last spring in our May 22, 2009 Radio EcoShock show, I teased listeners with the first 15 minutes of Cecile's book tour speech, recorded by Josh Reimer of VIP Video. Now you'll hear the rest. If we want to seriously save the planet, we need to bail out of consumerism, measuring ourselves by the brand names we buy. It turns out, we shop because we're unhappy with ourselves, and you can thank advertising for that. And we're unhappy because we have so few connections with family and community. The answer? Build community and the simplicity movement. It's something you can do yourself. Cecile Andrews tells you how. But why be so serious about it? Cecile's speech made me laugh out loud, and she wants you to have fun too. Here is Cecile Andrews continuing her talk called Simplicity.
And so something I like to read out of Slow is Beautiful, because it's always struck me as something that really summarizes what it is that we're talking about. And it's by a man named Robert Lane, who's an emeritus professor at Yale. And he talks about the effect of the way we're all living. And he says that there is, my hypothesis, he says, is that there is a kind of famine of warm interpersonal relations, of easy-to-reach neighbors, of encircling inclusive memberships, and of solidary family life. There is much evidence that for people lacking in social support of this kind, unemployment has more serious effects. Illnesses are more deadly, disappointment with one's children is harder to bear, bouts of depression last longer, and frustration and failed expectations of all kinds are more traumatic. And so everything is just worse without the social support. And so this is the thing that, you know, that you're going to have, is it next week or the week after on the September on the whole eco-village? And we have this whole thing
that's
going.
October, actually.
Okay. And then we're going to have, you know, somebody here from the Vancouver Village, and we'll talk a little bit more about this. But this whole idea that we have to give people this understanding, the importance of social ties. And so I'm always trying to think, how can we do this? And then I found the words of someone, Saint-Exupéry, who did The Little Prince, and he said that if you want to have someone build you a boat, you don't just gather people together and give them the wood and the plans and the tools. He said, no, what you do is you teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Don't you love that? That's how you get people to do something. You teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea, which means what we have to do is give people this vision of community, of letting them know what it is. And in many cases, it'll mean letting them experiencing it. But it not only, of course, makes people happier and healthier, it's better for the environment. I mean, we're working very hard to save the planet, but often it's just by giving people a bunch of facts. It's telling them little things that they can do. But if we help people come together in this sense of joyful community, they don't even want to go out and consume. They don't want to shop. They don't want to be the richest person in the world. And so we have to come up with a way to do that. It's also going to help democracy. because Robert Putnam in his book Bowling Alone says that, and this one I love, this is again particularly good for the States, that the culture in which people talk to each other over their back fence is the culture in which people vote. Isn't that incredible? It's like we can go out and do all we want to try to get people interested in politics, but if we got them to talk to their neighbors and got them involved in community, they're much more likely to vote, to be involved in all sorts of ways in democracy. And of course, this is how we get people to care about the common good, because they're experiencing being cared for. So, with this vision that the way we really bring about change, whether it's simplicity or in the environment, is to have people have this vision of community. So what are the barriers to community? Well, to me, the big barriers are, first, that we don't have enough fun and we don't have enough time. And the subtitle to my Slow is Beautiful book talks about joie de vivre. Now, I can at least come to Canada and you guys can say that. Nobody can say that anymore in the States. And, you know, people used to be able to say that. Nobody even knows about the concept of joy of living, joie de vivre, because I think it's because people don't have any use for it. They don't think about the joy of living, so they don't even have any words for it anymore. But this whole concept of joie de vivre, it's like, you know, we're supposed to be enjoying ourselves. And it's really true that what we want to do, and again, I'm going to come back to ask you about this, in the States is not have fun, not enjoy ourselves. We want to get a lot done. We want to be productive. We want to achieve, and we want to be number one. Isn't that strange? I heard somebody in one environmental group in Sustainable Seattle, and we were having a big meeting, and she stood up and she said, "We want to make Seattle the most sustainable city in the country." And I thought, what's this about? Mm-hmm. You want to be number one? What do you mean? You want to... I knew what it was. They were worried about Portland. You know, it's like Portland was taking over. But isn't that bizarre to have this worked in to this concept of somebody, we want to be number one in sustainability? So this whole sense of getting people to understand that they're supposed to be enjoying themselves. One of the books that I really like, I'm sure a lot of you like Barbara Ehrenreich's book, work, her last book, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Dancing in the Streets. She says this is so important because she said this is the thing that the people in charge want to get rid of, because people who are willing to dance in the streets are people you can't control. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a great way to look at it? People who know that what they're supposed to be doing is enjoying themselves are hard to control. But you can control the people who want to be number one, who want to be successful and achieve, by giving them all sorts of little rewards. So this is something that's particularly, and even though I don't even think we're very good in the whole United States, we're particularly bad in Seattle. We're really kind of repressed people in Seattle. You know, kind of go around with kind of frowns on our faces, out to save the world, but we're not having a whole lot of fun. Even in Palo Alto, they're doing better than we are. And this whole sense then of joie de vivre, but then the other thing that struck me that we have to have, and again, I think Canadians are better on this, but you still only have, what do you have, 2 weeks vacation? Is that what you have? Is that what is that you have given?
Generally, yes.
What?
Generally, yes, 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're way behind Europe, that this whole thing of leisure, of taking time off. And when I first did a lot of reading about leisure, the thing that struck me was I could see that nobody, I wasn't brought up even thinking about leisure. The only thing that came to my mind was like leisure suits. Did you guys have leisure suits? You know, and I think there were these ugly polyester gray things. And it's like we don't even have, again, a word for leisure. But for me, this idea, it's not just about having more time, but like taking your time, moving slowly. I had somebody say that to me in a store the other day. They just said, "Oh, take your time." And I thought, "Oh, I haven't heard that for a long time. Take your time." She said, "I have plenty of time." And this sense of having the opportunity to think and feel deeply, that without leisure you can't do that. And the person, of course, who sums that up the best for me that I have a quote from is Thoreau. This is probably one of my favorite Thoreau quotes. He said, "I love a broad margin to my life. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance." Don't you love that? Mm-hmm. Now, if you start your day out reading that every day, your day will go much better. But you have this vision of taking your time. And it's interesting because I had this kind of a same experience a couple of summers ago when I had just hung my sheets out to dry in my backyard. It was one of those beautiful days that we get in the Northwest. Like was it beautiful here yesterday?
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's sunny, but it's not too hot. There's a teeny little breeze. And so I had hung my sheets out to dry, and I sat down in my wonderful outdoor chair. And then all of a sudden, I realized that it had been 45 minutes, and all I had been doing was watching my sheets dry. I mean, the breeze would come, and they would billow out a little bit, and I thought, and you could see they were getting lighter. And I thought, I've been watching water evaporate. And I realized that a few years before, I would have thought, oh, my God, 45 minutes? You know, I could have gotten something read. I could have written something. I could have done something. And I realized that this was the most important thing to do, was to be able to sit there and watch my sheets dry. Now, when you do that, what you do is you don't feel like running out to a shopping mall. You don't feel like getting busy. You feel like taking your time. I also have a quote from another favorite writer that she really says this well, from Virginia Woolf. She really sums all this up. She says, "If people are highly successful in their professions, they lose their sense. Sight goes. They have no time to look at pictures. Sound goes. They have no time to listen to music. Speech goes. They have no time for conversation. Humanity goes. Money making becomes so important that they must work by night as well as by day. Health goes. And so competitive do they become that they will not share their work with others, though they have more than they can do themselves. What then remains of a human being who has lost sight, sound, and a sense of proportion? Only a cripple in a cave." Isn't that good? I mean, this was 1937. And she just summed it up. That money-making, at least, and again, when I talk to Canadians, I think, you know, you're not as bad as we are in the States.
Oh.
But you could be. And that you can look at us as a cautionary tale, you know, that we don't want to be like them. And so this whole thing of one woman came up to me, one woman said in one workshop, and she said, you know, she says, we all think that someday we'll start living. And that's what we're all trying to do, someday. And so I used to go before, like me and my husband, quit our full-time jobs. I used to go while he was still a full-time reporter, and he'd be sitting there at his computer working and typing away. And I'd say to him, this is it. It's probably not going to get much better. And so he would look up and go back to his typing. But I know he did get through. I got through to him. So what else can we do besides trying to give this vision and create this, that there is something that's more important than money-making? One, the facts. Facts don't work for everyone, but there is one particular fact. You know, every once in a while you discover a fact that's like, whoa. Because I really can't remember many facts. I was an English major, and well, that must be an English major, right? We didn't have to have facts. But this one fact that seemed to me so important, that the biggest indicator for the health of a country, health of a nation, as measured in longevity, is the gap between the rich and the poor. And they have done this research over and over and over, and they have found this to be so true. The bigger the gap, then the longevity is going down. Now, you know, a lot of people think, well, this is because poor people have poorer health, and that's part of it. But the biggest thing about it is when you have this gap, it destroys social ties. When you have that gap, everyone becomes very competitive. Other people are your enemies. They're not your friends. Trust has gone way down in the States. I mean, when I think of that young woman, you know, coming up and you know, yelling at this older woman trying to park. But when you have this gap, this gap, everyone is trying to claw their way up. And when people have this, you know, somebody has lower status than they are, they treat them differently. And they treat them as if they're not as important. And it's like everybody, though, has somebody who's more important than they are. So nobody has this ease and this sense of social ties that people have in countries with a lower gap. Now, Canada has a lower gap than the U.S. And this is one of the reasons I said that you always seem more intelligent to me. And it's very true that they have found that this gap causes, it accounts for crime, it accounts for obesity, it accounts for mental illness, it accounts for all sorts of things, that instead of having all these different programs, you work on this. Now, this is the thing that, for me, again, one piece of research found that people who came to the United States, Hispanics who came to the United States, and still only spoke Spanish and lived together in their separate little enclaves, did not suffer the effects of having lower social status until they went out and started commingling with the rest of society, that then they began to feel the effects of status. So what it says to me is one of the things that we have to do is create these communities where people feel equal, where people feel valued, where people can be themselves, and that has some mitigating effect on the other consequences of the gap between the rich and the poor. So it seems to me incredibly important. And so this is where, and we'll talk later about the Village Vancouver, that this whole movement of people creating communities, particularly in their neighborhoods, to bring people together. And I live in a community in a neighborhood in Seattle called Finney, and we have formed a Finney Eco-Village. It's not a real eco-village. It's just we have a whole bunch of them now around the Bay Area. Have any of you heard of scallops? I mean, not the seafood, but it's an acronym, Sustainable Communities All Over Puget Sound. Isn't that clever? Scallops? And so we have all sorts of neighborhoods in Seattle. We have Sustainable Ballard, Sustainable Queen Anne, Sustainable Capitol Hill, Sustainable Ballard, Sustainable Fremont. And so we have now and it goes all the way up to Bellingham, down to Olympia. We have over 45 of these communities. And then we come together. And what we try to do within each neighborhood is to create community and to work on sustainability. But the community has to come first. And if you have community, sustainability follows, because you begin to share. You don't care about going out and shopping. And you begin to think about the common good. So some of the things that we do in our neighborhood, I want to give you some examples. One of the things I particularly focus on is bringing people together to talk together. I had a friend who said to me when she saw me starting yet again another small group, she said, "Oh, Cecile, you're doing it again. You must have been a sheepdog in a former life." And I thought, yes, indeed, that's what I am. I go around barking at people's heels, trying to herd them together. And it's nice to know your essential identity. Actually, there is a little quiz you can take that helps you figure out what kind of a dog you are. Yes. And so what we do, of course, one of the things we have is a voluntary simplicity circle. And it's so important, and this is what I've been working on over the years, it's so important when you're trying to live more simply to have some kindred spirits to talk to. So people, you know, they can, because if you, people are talking about their favorite thrift store or what they saved their money on, or, you know, other people can look at you as if you're just really strange. But here, everybody knows what you're talking about. So this is one thing, to get a simplicity circle going. We do something in one of our local bookstores in our neighborhood. We call it, it's the name of the bookstore is Santoros, and it's called the Santoros Subversive Salon. And this is different than a lot of book discussion groups. Now, it was interesting because I had been in some book discussion groups, and I discovered that often they're very competitive. And that you go away from the, your book discussion group feeling horrible because somebody looked at you like you, you know, why did you pick that book? You know, why do you like that book? And then I read something in the New York Times that said there was a whole new field of therapy for people who'd been in book discussion groups because they became so competitive. Isn't that incredible? And so what we decided to do was we just come together once a month and we talk about what we're reading. And it doesn't matter, so there's no pressure. And sometimes my husband even cheats. He'll talk about books that he's planning to read. He hasn't even read yet. And so it, we what we want people to do is not focus on the literariness. We want people to have the relationships. And it's when you're in those kinds of groups that you have this kind of laughter, that people are laughing just because they're together. And it has an incredible, you go away feeling really, really good. And so to have that kind of group, another thing that we did, we wanted to start a group that we called, well, the reason we started this group, when I lived in San Francisco once, I lived on this incredible street, Chestnut Street, if you know it, not far from the marina. It's one of those streets when you walk down, everything is there. So you never have to leave. You know, there are all sorts of cafes and bookstores and theaters. But in front of the cafes, there are always these old guys sitting there all day just talking, just hanging out and talking. And I thought to myself, that's what I want in my life. I want to have some place where I can just sit like one of those old guys and just talk. And, oh, see, you think so too? Do you agree? No? No?
Perhaps you're looking for an old guy.
Well, so we thought, how can we do this? So we started at one of our local cafes in my neighborhood. But first it was just we meet every Wednesday at 1 at May's Cafe. And first we started calling it the Home Alone Group. Because that's for people who were working at home. And you lose your community when you're working at home. But nobody liked that name. Apparently they thought it meant they were losers. So they changed it to the Think Tank. And it's so much fun because we just gather. And the interesting thing for me is that these are not people who are my close friends. I don't see them outside of this group. But I've become so fond of them just because we come together just to hang out. No other reason. So that's one of the things we do. Another one that we really advocate, and it's more on the personal realm, and I got this from, any of you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David? Yes. You know, and Larry David is this curmudgeonly old guy, and he hates to see people and stop and chat. You know, if he sees somebody he knows coming down the street, he thinks, oh God, he goes across the street so he doesn't have to talk to him. So I thought, this is what we need. We need stop and chats. We need to encourage people to go out into their neighborhood and stop and chat. And so we've made this kind of one of our projects to encourage people to do this. And my husband, who's really kind of an introvert, he loves these stop and chats. And he'll come home, and it used to be if he'd come home like he was late and he'd get in trouble. Now all he has to do is say, I had 3 stop and chats, and he's off the hook because he's out there talking to people. And so we realized that, you know, we want to do big things to change the world, but we can do these little things by talking to people. And so we came up with a whole bunch of ideas. One of them we thought of is grocery line activism. And I got this idea because I was watching my husband once. He has these shorts that are really cute, and they're made out of hemp. But everybody's always saying, oh, I love your shorts. And then he starts talking about hemp and how important it is to the environment and you know, why can't we have it in this country? And I watched him one day. He was in the grocery store line, and he had the grocery store checker and the bagger and the person behind. They were all talking about hemp and saying, oh, it's a corporation. And I thought, he's got a little revolution going right there in the grocery line. And so we realized this is something we next. You know what you usually do, right? You look to see which line looks shortest. Now look to see which line has the most interesting people. And you can start this grocery line activism. The other thing we thought of was cell phone subversion. And this is, I don't know if this is true here because Canadians are not quite as loud as Americans, but on the buses when people talk on their cell phones, they tend to talk really loud. Is that true?
That's here too.
Is that here too?
Everywhere.
Well, you know, and frankly, I like it. It makes the bus ride much more interesting. You know, they're usually talking about what they did the night before. And I thought to myself, hey, you could take your cell phone. You wouldn't even need to be talking to anybody, right? And you could start saying like, it isn't relevant anymore, but oh, I did not know what is relevant. You could start saying, my God, did you hear what Cheney said last night about torture? I mean, what can you... And people, pretty soon, everybody's listening to you. And you don't have, you know... Isn't that a good idea? You just say whatever you want in a loud voice. And then we thought of also of elevator ambush. And that is, you carry a newspaper with you at all times. And when you're on the elevator, those doors close, you whip out your paper, right? Look at what that Cheney is doing. My God, what's the matter with that man? And then the doors open and you walk away, but you got your say in. So you begin to think. You begin to think about how can you talk to people and you begin to make a difference. And not in a way that scares people, but in a way that invites people to respond to you.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're examining our need to rush around and buy things. Maybe there's a better way. Cecile Andrews is a community educator with a doctorate and a wicked sense of humor. She and her husband Paul are founders of the Finney Eco Village, a project to bring sustainability and community in her North Seattle neighborhood. Back to Cecile Andrews speaking in Vancouver, Canada on May 11th, 2009.
So these are some other ideas. I want to give you some other ideas about how to live more simply. And these are some things that I have discovered work well over the years. One is to try to lower your standards. You know, have really low standards about things, and then nobody expects much from you. And so you don't have to get in a tizzy. And so, for instance, you know, if you have a potluck to go to, you know, take a watermelon. Now, you know, people know I can't cook, so they never expect anything more. A watermelon. One year, in one summer, I went to 5 picnics with the same watermelon. Really? People would get to the end, and since it hadn't been cut, people would just not cut it. And so I would take it home, take it to the next picnic. And so you say, see how you're saving yourself time? What?
Plastic.
Plastic? I wouldn't go that far, thank you. Another thing we do is that I like to have people over, but again, I am a bad cook. But then when I started having potlucks, first I felt a little uncomfortable, like making people bring their food. And then I thought, people know I can't cook. They'd much rather bring their food so they have something that's really good to eat. So you have your standards low. And one of the things we do, we have something called movie night, and all we serve is popcorn. So it's like an easy way. And you can, you know, you can show, and we don't necessarily show documentaries. We show like Burn After Reading. Has anybody seen Burn? I know. If you haven't seen Burn After Reading, it gets better the more you watch it. But just have people over and just serve popcorn. And it's so, because so many people, at least in the States, don't have people over because they think their house doesn't look good enough. So I try to keep my house not too clean so people feel comfortable. They think, well, she can have people over. I can have people over. So then the other thing, probably the really best thing, is to tell people you're involved in the voluntary simplicity movement, because then, again, they don't... I can wear the same clothes day after day, and nobody thinks, they think she's simplifying her life, and they don't think anything of it. So being in the voluntary simplicity movement will help. Another thing is, and this is my goal in life, and this is really important, to see if you can get through the day without rushing. Because essentially what we're talking about is people savoring their lives, people enjoying their lives, and if you rush, you don't. And so some of the things like you know, pushing when you get into an elevator, you can push your floor. Don't push the closed door button. You know, that thing. They're not hooked up. They just want you to They just want you to go like this. It's the same thing with crossing streets, I think. They're not hooked up. So you just stand there. You just stand there and wait. It's kind of like a test for you, you know, to see if you can do this. And another piece of good advice is don't switch lanes. And again, this is like the... Yes, exactly. This is like you're in a grocery store, right? And you're looking around to find the lane that's going the fastest, the line that's going the fastest, and you find one. And then do you just stand there and chat? No. Look around to see if there's another one that's going faster. But all your life experience has told you, don't change the line you're in. But you think, this time is an exception. I can see. So you get over to that new line. Are you happy? No, you're watching where you were to see if you... And then the person in front of you can't find her wallet. And so you're not only angry at her, which might tempt you to throw chocolate-covered raisins, you are also upset with yourself. So you choose the line that looks like it has the most interesting people, pick up a magazine, and start chatting. And another place it works, and you're of the people I can talk to, my husband and I always would have a fight when we go across the border. Why would we have a fight? Because we would pick one of the lines, and then we would see, and I'd say to my husband, do you see that yellow car? We were ahead of that car. Why did you pick this lane? So our rule now is, and we did it today, and it worked perfectly, we pick the lane to the farthest right, and we don't look up. We just keep our head down. And then you just, I mean, this is an exercise. Isn't it ridiculous to get all upset about little things like this? So this don't rushing, this slowing down, because a lot of the reason people are consuming and they're going after to be successful is because they're not happy. And if they have this sense of happiness, these other things, they lose the desire for them. Another one is that people need big chunks of uninterrupted time. There are two new books out, one called Distracted, which shows how we're almost never absorbed. I think being absorbed, like watching my sheets dry, we need that kind. And then there's another one out called Wrapped, about when do you feel, you know, wrapped, that you're enraptured, really. You're totally involved and totally just kind of forget what's going on around you. So you need that kind of time. And so you have to, I don't know, this is very hard, and I'd be interested to hear how people do it. It means you're not going to multitask. It means that you're not going to be texting all the time. And is that a problem here? People running into things because they're texting? My husband was watching one day, this young woman was driving a car. She very slowly, nobody else was coming, very slowly went to turn left, but he could see she was texting. And she ran right into a telephone pole. And she looked up, and then she just, and she just backed up and drove away, leaving part of her fender there. It was like the most bizarre thing. And so this thing of so some of the things to have more uninterrupted time, again, in cutting back, one of the things that we found is one of the nicest things you can do for people. One year we were having a party. This is obviously before email, because we had to cancel the party, so we called people up. And we told them that we had to cancel the party, and people would go kind of like, oh, well, that's too bad. And we could see they were happy to have the party canceled because it gave them a free night. So we realized that one of the nicest things you could do for people is to cancel something. You know, if you're a supervisor at work, call a meeting, then cancel it. People, morale, don't you think? The morale goes up immediately if you cancel something, even if it's something they thought they wanted to do. And so developing some more slow skills. When I think of to-do lists, sometimes it seems like, you know, the high point in our day is crossing something off of our... Isn't that pathetic? It's like, oh, this is what's satisfying, is crossing something off of your to-do list. So what we recommend is crossing things off of your list, even if you haven't done them. Just go through. You know that comedian Stephen Wright, the guy who talks like this and he goes around like this, he says he goes to people's houses and he finds their to-do list on their refrigerator and he adds things. So we can go around and find their to-do list and we can cross things off their list. And you can just see them. I don't remember doing this, but it's crossed off. I must have done it. And you're doing is kind of like a secret friend. You're making their lives go better. And I had, and this to me is the height of everything, is to learn to hang out and to be like those old guys in front of that cafe. And I had one woman after a workshop who came up and said, and she had a latte in her hand, and here we were in Seattle, and she said, you know what the chief difference is between our cultures? And she said, in our culture, when we have a latte, we take a couple of hours to talk with our friends. But you use a latte for fuel. That you're driving through an espresso stand and you're getting a coffee to go. And you're drinking it alone in your car. Isn't that the image? And then somebody told me that in Europe, the cars that they make don't even have cup holders. And I saw an ad in an airport for... a car, and all it said on it was, yes, it has cup holders. Isn't that? I mean, you begin to see that the South African poet Brayton Breytenbach said that Americans have mastered the art of living with the unacceptable. And you begin to see all the bizarre things. And then somebody said that they saw an SUV that had over 30 cup holders. And you know how the SUVs will tumble over. I had this vision of people upside down with their coffee draining out of their cups. And so it's kind of like, you know, to get people to think about simplicity, that they have to figure, one, see how bizarre our lives are, but they have to have a vision of this joyful community. So what I want you to do now is I'm going to have you talk in groups of threes. Now, if you're like people in Seattle, you're thinking, oh, God, she's going to make us talk. But I guarantee you will like it. So I want you to try to talk to people you didn't come with. Of course, then I started thinking, you know, if you're married, do you know, and this is just research on married couples, do you know how much the average time a married couple talk each day? I'm going to hear some guesses on this. Does anybody have 25 minutes. He said 25. I want you to see who says it. You said 25.
I said
this guy's saying 10.
I said 3.
You said 22?
10.
Oh, 10?
3.
3? That's horrible. I, honest to God, well, I had, it's 12 minutes. I was talking to a group of young women, AmeriCorps women, and I asked them this, and none of them were married, and they all guessed about 2 hours. And I had to tell them it was only 12 minutes. I felt so horrible. But anyway, so then when I wanted to have married couples not talk, then I thought, maybe it's better to let the married couples talk. This is the only chance you'll get. So I want you to try to talk, and some of you will turn around. Only try to do it in three. Occasionally, you have a group of four, but no more. And I want you to talk about the experiences of community that you are having in your life right now. And how much you have, and is this meaningful, and or something that you want to do, or something you know about. But talk about community. So get into small groups of three. You can turn around, move your chairs, whatever. And I don't want anybody to leave. I want to bar those doors. As I say, if you're like us Seattleites, nobody wants to talk to anybody. But you'll just turn and talk about community.
Thank you.
what I want to hear is what, just think for a second about your experience of community, and what is the one central core that makes it community? Like one word or one phrase that, like one of my favorite experiences of community was when I was in graduate school and in graduate student housing. And I just love that because being a graduate student housing, you could go out of the door anytime and there were people around. It's like it was people were available. And now to see people, usually have, you know, you go back and forth in your email several times and try to figure out a time, and then somebody can't do it. And so for me, it was availability makes something community. So what's one word for you or one phrase? Yes?
Sharing.
Okay, sharing. And so that's one word. Share experience is the same thing. What else?
Support.
Feeling of support?
Respect.
Respect? Is that what you said, respect? Support, sharing,
ease.
Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? Ease.
Ease.
Ease. So say a little bit more about
ease.
Okay, did somebody
have meals together?
Food is a big one, isn't it? That's a really big one these days. So.
Fun.
Mm-hmm.
Or celebration.
Celebration. You know, it used to be, you know, yesterday was Mother. Wasn't Mother's Day here, right?
Yeah.
Was it here too? Well,
well,
you don't have some other things that we have. So, but I always told my kids, I don't believe in Mother's Day. You know, all it is a corporate holiday, you know, so they can sell more stuff, you know. So my kids loved hearing that. But then I realized we need to take any chance for celebration that we can. You know, we should have, you know, what? Dog day. Do we have a dog day?
Every day is a dog day.
You know, we need to find some ways of all sorts of celebrations. So now we do practice Mother's Day at my family now. So celebration, yes. So what else in community?
Familiarity.
That's an interesting one because it comes to ease almost. Like, I love going to the same restaurant over and over, so when I walk in, they know my order. And that doesn't sound like a big thing, does it? But it's there is something about that makes you feel very good. So familiarity.
Support.
You're having people feel, you know, that yes, they're on your side. Exactly. This side is doing much better than this side, I will have to say.
Gathering.
I know, and some of you probably know about the book, The Great Good Place. It's an incredible book, and how important it is to have cafes, places like that to hang out, and that they're disappearing because people can't afford the rents. And it almost always seems to need to be an old place and these new places. I don't know if you're having this happening, but we're having this horrible, all these development things that are just huge, so nobody's going to know anybody else, and so they have down at the bottom, they're all vacant. There's nothing except a tanning salon, and that's about the only thing that goes in. Why can tanning salons afford to move in when other places can't? I don't know. Of course, I don't know. Well, who am I talking to? Vancouver, like Seattle, Vancouver. Maybe if we went to, you know, Los Angeles, they wouldn't have any tanning salons. Or maybe they would. I bet they do in Los Angeles. Anything else for community? Yes.
Listening,
understanding, and non-judgment. And just think how rarely it is that we get to experience that. You know, you just don't. And I don't know, are you guys working more and more hours like we are? You know, America, the United States now works the most hours in the world. That we just, you know, work all sorts of hours. And people now are also, they're not just, they're glued to their computers too. So they're not intermingling. They're not hanging out. And so they don't have this feeling of support. So other things about community that you talked about that seem particularly important?
Non-competitiveness.
Non-competitiveness. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's, again, it's so hard to get away from that. See, this is my theory about Dick Cheney. Sorry, I keep coming back to Dick Cheney.
Okay.
Right. It's like, is he trying to totally ruin the Republican Party by going on? Well, my theory is he feels if he's not the leader anymore, he doesn't care if it succeeds. You know those kind of really competitive people? Don't you think that makes sense? I have a fixation. What?
Just ruin the game for everybody.
Yes, ruin the game for everybody else. That's exactly it. It's kind of like, I'm not there anymore, so too bad for you. And what I think is interesting is that, you know, one of the things that Obama says, that we're trying to create this society in which we're all in this together, that we are in a society in which it's every man for himself. And how do we move? And it's not that, and so some people, like Dick Cheney, would say that people are basically selfish, they're basically out for themselves. And others would argue that we have in us the capability to be both generous and selfish, and it is your society that creates which kind you are. And if you think of what, and this is why it's so relevant to simplicity, if you think what advertisement does, is it says you're unacceptable. Yeah. And two, it builds in this status thing that you have to be, and also that you care about your appearance all the time. So that makes people into these narcissists, and narcissists have fewer social skills. And it's interesting because we spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about American culture of, you know, you're going to go out the cowboy and you're out on the range by yourself, and so that we were very, very individualistic. And then I read something that made sense. It says, if you come from a culture in which people see their security as other people, then that's one thing. But if you don't come from that culture and you don't see people as your security, then you see money and things as your security. So we must say other people are your security. And that's basically. And then this extreme desire. Now, obviously, advertising and corporations and everything. But the thing about social change is, one of the main things about simplicity is it says that you can do something right away. And it's not only consuming less yourself, but it is going out and hanging out with other people. So you make an immediate difference. You know, the big thing is that if you can get people to do some little thing, they're more likely to do the next thing. Because they see themselves as people who take action and people who can make a difference. And also, it has to be enjoyable. You know, I have been in too many political discussions where we've ended up screaming at each other. And so we scare people. One of the things that where I live down Highway 9, not far from Highway 99, we have a banner every Tuesday morning, which we've been doing for many years, trying to end the Iraq War. And when they first started doing it, everybody was just like, you know, ugh. And I thought, you know, they're just sour. And I thought, I don't want to hang out with these people. So we made it our goal to get people to laugh and smile. And so now when you drive under and you see the banner, it might say something like, you know, 500,000 people killed, but you see all these people laughing and smiling above, which is a little strange. But then you think, people think, I want to join them. They're having such a good time up there trying to change the world. And so the whole thing about simplicity, again, is trying to figure out, you know, what's important and what matters, and that you can start by doing something. And a lot of us, again, and you go around and you tell people your stories. I mean, I like to tell people that one of the things we did, we live in a big house near Green Lake, and we decided, after I'd been around people who lived more simply, we decided we made an apartment on the bottom floor, an apartment on the top floor, and we just live in the middle. And it was interesting because before, people knew we did it to simplify our lives. Before, people would have said, oh, what's the matter with poor Paul and Cecile? You know, they're not making it. They have to take in boarders, you know. And but I tell people about this. Or I tell them that this, you know, to get out of this horrible winter this year, my husband and I did a house exchange in the Bay Area. And it was just a wonderful thing. It cost us nothing, and we did a house exchange. And that there, how many people have done like couch surfing? Anybody did? And
what do you mean?
Well, couch surfing, you go on and you can go all over the world, and you just sign up for this on the website, and you can go to people's houses and stay for free. I mean, there are all these things that people are figuring out how to do to save money, but they almost always end up building community. And instead, what money has bought us, it has bought us distance. Yeah. And so, you know, to tell these stories about having more fun while you're living simply. Money's bought us loneliness. Exactly. And so what I want to do is I want to tell you my final story, and then we can break up and have, you don't want to take those home with you, so no. You can break up and we'll have time to mingle a little bit. But every time you have a meeting, make sure you have a meeting that isn't dull and horrible, but that people have some time to talk with each other and some time to get together and just make that, just think of your stop and chats. That the way you're changing things with stop and chats. And if you're not an extrovert, what you need is, oh, where is that picture in here? If you're not an extrovert, what you do is you get a little white dog to walk around with. My little Bichon, everybody wants to talk to her. And so I'm able to start lots of conversations because she's so cute. And so what I want to do to finish up, I love this story, and it's the way I finish Slow is Beautiful, is, and when I wrote it, the man, it's about Kurt Vonnegut, was still alive, and of course he died not long ago. Oh, there's one other quote I have too, that we have to pay attention to these voices. I've got this quote from Studs Terkel, and you all know Studs Terkel, and he died not a few months ago. And he said, people ask him about the lessons of the Great Depression. And he says, the lessons of the Great Depression. He says, don't blame yourself. Turn to others. Take part in the community. And the big boys are not that bright. Don't you love that? Don't you love that? So all of these things, I mean, from Studs Terkel, that this is the lesson of the Depression. You turn to each other. So my story with Kurt Vonnegut is Kurt Vonnegut, as you probably know, never used a computer on his writing. And he would type on his typewriter, and he would type in the morning, and when he would be done, he would call up the person who did his editing, and he would chat for a little while and ask how the kids were, and, you know, could he send over his stuff for her to do the editing. She'd say, sure, and then he'd have to go out to the store, to the stationery store, to get an envelope, and he'd stand in line, and he'd chat for a while, and then he'd go to the post office to mail this, and again, stand in line, and he said he had always been all these years secretly in love with the postmistress, but he didn't really ever let her know. And then one day he went home, and he said, his wife said, your morning is gone. You've wasted it. You know, get a computer. All you have to do is write and then send it off. You wouldn't have your whole morning disappear. And he said, and then what would my life be like? And he said, we are here on this earth, and don't let anybody ever tell you different. We are on this earth to fart around. Thank you.
That was Cecile Andrews talking about her new book, Less is More, Embracing Simplicity for a Healthy Planet, a Caring Economy, and a Lasting Happiness, co-authored with Wanda Urbanski. It's from New Society Publishers. Andrews' previous books include Slow is Beautiful and Circle of Simplicity. The new book contains short essays from many helpful authors. For example, Sarah Susanska talks about the role of clutter in our lives, while David Corton works on connecting and caring. Andrews is also involved in the Take Back Your Time campaign, which has asked Congress to make 3 weeks vacation a minimum for all Americans. Find that at www.timeday.org. Find Cecile's blog at lessismoresimplicity.blogspot.com. You can download her full talk from the speeches section of our audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org. I'd like to thank Josh Reimer of VIP Video in Vancouver for his recording. So what do you think? Can we give up our compulsion to go for the fast lane, no matter what it costs the planet or our own sanity? Are you ready for slow talk, activism, and community building? I started living the simple life a couple of decades ago, and I'm so thankful I did. The seasons don't pass, the moon doesn't change its phases in the sky without me knowing about it. Join us in reclaiming our lives from the machine. I'm Alex Smith, your host on Radio EcoShock. Write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for tuning in.
With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. From the debut album Audio Visuals, these are the Administrators singing Stuck in Our Ways. Find it on YouTube.
To leave.